Hello and welcome to Gascast, your independent critical care research, anesthesia and pain podcast. I'm Rick Thomas, and helping me deliver the news, discoveries, research and some commentary are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Frank Schneider.
Hello.
And Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
So, hi guys. I had to change the introduction a little bit because now we've changed our content. I actually don't know what's coming up in the podcast, which is a nice surprise. I need to come up with something probably a bit snappier. Did you get the acronym there I'm using?
No.
No, just repeat it again slowly.
It's for the Critical Care Research Anesthesia and Pain podcast.
Oh.
So it's crap.
It is crap. It's double C crap. I thought everyone's doing it now with FOMED and SMAC, which I only learnt the other day is social media and critical care, but I think we should have an acronym as well. We can start hashtag crap.
So we're yeah. C-crap.
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 But cool, it is actually.
Well, at least we're pretty sure that's not been taken by anyone else.
No one's unlikely to challenge us for that one either. Yeah. But yeah, so welcome to the C-Crap podcast. It was a success last month, I think. We managed to get ourselves under 45 minutes and under at least 2 days worth of editing to get it up to speed. So that kind of worked, and I look forward to taking it forward this month. Everyone knows who's doing what?
Yep.
Hopefully.
Yep.
So, shall we start with the medical news, which I've done. I'm going to try and make this not too ranty. It's quite a nice section to do, going through the various news items and bits and pieces. But I've got to say, once again, I'm hugely frustrated by the inability to get hold of various journal articles. So even though, after last week, and Frank, you said, you know, you need the NHS Athens access to get the BNF app, which I subsequently went and did, which is great. I'm at a new hospital. I've got a new Athens login. Despite having that, I still can't get access to most things. The BMJ now works. JAMA kind of works. NEJM didn't really work. And even though it should take me through, it doesn't, which is really, really irritating. So this month, I'm going to start with PLOS, which I love. Obviously, there's PLOS One and there's PLOS Medicine. All completely open access, and if you use any online apps for your journals, for the journals you do read or do have subscriptions to, for instance, the BJR Anesthesia, I've got to say the PLOS website is brilliant. It seems to work on any machine I use. It's really easy to read the articles as HTML without having to download them as PDFs, and I love it. So we'll start with PLOS. Things that interested me in PLOS this month were starting with, if you go to their most read, number one on their leaderboard is an article titled "Why Most Published Research Findings Are False," which is excellent. It's got over 1,000 citations and nearly 1 million views. So this is an article with lots of really interesting and complex stats showing you why most published research is in fact false, and so if it's asking a single binary question, you can pretty much just go with whatever the opposite is, which has a great impact for everything else we're about to discuss on this podcast. But it puts it down to six corollaries, which it lists, which I'll just go through very quickly. One, the smaller the studies conducted in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. Number two, the smaller the effect sizes in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. Number three, the greater the number and the lesser the selection of tested relationships in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. Number four, the greater the flexibility in designs, definitions, outcomes, and analytical modes in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. And number five, the greater the financial and other interests and prejudices in the scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. And finally, the hotter a scientific field, i.e. with more scientific teams involved, the less likely the research findings are to be true. And it goes on to explain all of these in far more detail than I can go into now, or to be honest, completely understand. But really, really worth reading and trying to get your head around, because that was very interesting. Other things on PLOS which I liked was the social relationships and mortality risk, a meta-analytic review. And this is not a paper showing that if you have more friends on Facebook, you live longer, I'm afraid. Well, actually, that's probably good news for me. But it was showing that social relationships, particularly the quality and quantity, were very important in your long-term survival. they had several hundred thousand people in this meta-analysis and showed that it was the quality and quantity of social relationships that was important. And they cited a decrease in intergenerational living, greater social mobility, delayed marriage, dual career families, and an increase in single residence households as the reason for this quite large effect that they saw. And there's a great quote from the middle of the paper. Social relationships, or relative lack thereof, constitute a major risk factor for health, rivaling the effect of well-established health risk factors such as cigarette smoking, blood pressure, blood lipids, obesity, and physical activity. So quite interesting there. And then the last thing on PLOS, which I suggest you have a look at, is How to Stir Up Trouble. Their editor-in-chief, who's Ginny Barber, is leaving. I think she's been in post for not quite, but nearly 10 years. And it just goes through her experience with the open access model of publishing, which I'm sure we're all going to go over to. To me, it's exactly the same way that the music industry had to radically change the way it delivered its content starting about 10 years ago. And I think the academic publishing industry is going through exactly the same thing. But it's a little bit about her story doing it, how she thinks everything's going to or must inevitably go over to this kind of model, and then links to some of the articles which she's most enjoyed either writing or editing, including Lethal Injection, Measuring the Impact of War, Big Pharma, and Ghostwriting, none of which I've read, but all of which I will read on the plane when I'm going away in a week's time. So moving through to the BMJ, what was big or what I saw this month, there was an article looking at suicide rates in 2008 around the global economic crisis, and found that there was indeed an increase in men, not women, in countries where the global economic crisis has had its biggest effect and was indeed linked to unemployment. So I guess no huge surprise there. We all must have done our anaesthetic exams when negative marking was still occurring. Is that right?
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, negative marking was taken away, I think, a few years ago from medical education generally, or certainly postgraduate exams. I think anesthesia was one of the last places to have it. But the reason being, it was discovered to be both racist and sexist, because it basically, you always do better than your 50-50 chance, even if you don't know anything about the question, presumably because you know something about the subject, or even if you consciously don't know something about it, there may be some kind of memory engram somewhere that means you have a greater than 50-50 chance. So over a large number of questions, which they inevitably are, if you do random guess and you are a risk taker, you will probably end up doing better than if you don't random guess and just answer the ones you know. So this strategy basically encourages risk-taking behavior, which self-selects, or sorry, not self-selects, but selects for white males. So I think the Royal College of GP was the first one to drop it, and then eventually anesthesia dropped it a few years ago, but we all still did it and remember the various different tactics and techniques there were for trying to maximize your work. Anyway, another study has been done on clinical exams relating to the MRCGP by a biostatistics professor, and has shown that candidates from ethnic minorities, both those who are trained abroad and those who are trained in this country, are less likely to pass. And when you do linear regression, it is related to their ethnicity rather than their where they trained in, which is interesting. I'm not quite sure what effect that's going to have on the way we do our exams, but worth a read. Coming on to things in the BMJ more related to anesthesia and critical care. So no big surprise, but cardiac patients, there's been a study looking at our gastric ulcer prophylaxis protection and showing that PPIs rather than H2 antagonists increase your chance of having a nosocomial infection. So take everyone off the pantoprazole and put them back onto the ranitidine if you can, first line. I know our pharmacist is actually particularly good at making sure that happens. And finally, in the BMJ, a study showing that antiplatelet treatment with clopidogrel and aspirin, if you divide your treatment group up into those who smoke and those who don't smoke, you do get a significant risk reduction in mortality from, I think, stroke and MI in the smokers, but not really in the non-smokers. So showing that those drugs are potentially not particularly effective at reducing mortality, which I think has quite a big impact. Need to look into that further. So JAMA, again, critical care, randomized controlled trial, multi-centered, looking at the use of gown and gloves on ICU patients and whether that reduces composite outcome of MRSA and VRE rates? And the answer, surprise, surprise, it does not. On that particular composite outcome, having gown and gloves before you enter the room has no effect. However, the interesting effect is it does decrease significantly the number of entries and exits into the room by healthcare workers, presumably because they've got that barrier of having to stick on the gown and gloves. There was, in fact, though, an effect on MRSA alone, although it was just significant. Although coming back to the plus one medicine article on why most published research findings are false, we can, of course, now expect it to be the opposite. But that was quite interesting. Other nuggets from JAMA. Cranberry juice is not effective for UTIs. However, trials showed a remarkable lack of both compliance, statistical power, and in fact use of the active ingredient cranberry juice. So that was a good sentence telling us absolutely nothing. And a study from Denmark looking at 10 years of bystander CPR data showed that the 10-year survival was increased by bystander CPR, which is a good long outcome, but probably not due to the CPR itself, but other related interventions, presumably such as calling an ambulance. And finally, Neejum. Neejum have a really nice feature on the front of their webpage. It's called Neejum Quick Take, and they basically make a paper into a little cartoon explaining what they did and what the outcome was, which is fantastic. So that's well worth a look. This one's on cesarean or vaginal delivery for twins. And finally, there is a bit of research in there looking at the long-term cognitive impairment after critical illness. 821 patients, 74 of them developed delirium, which is pretty consistent with, I think, all of our findings on ICU. But at 12 months, 34% still had, in the older population, and 24% in the younger, still had a significant cognitive deficit, similar to those with traumatic brain injury, which just goes to show the long-reaching consequences of critical illness. And that is the news.
We need a jingle or something.
Yeah.
Some anticlimax.
Was it? I expect you to say, brilliant, Rick, I've learned so much in under 8 minutes on what's going on in the world. But yeah, okay, we'll have to find a news jingle and get that up. Okay, so Bex, why don't you let us know what has been new on the education front this month?
So I looked at a couple of different sources. One of the first ones was from Medscape. The Medscape website has got some quite nice continued medical education presentations. How they do it is they choose a topic and then they present it as a filmed discussion between several experts, which is on one side of the screen. And then they have a PowerPoint slideshow progressing at the same time, but on the other side of the screen. And the most recent topic that they have done is reversal from neuromuscular blockade. And what I like about these CME modules, it's not just, sort of similar to rereading one of your textbooks from your FRCA syllabus. It discusses the most relevant studies. So you feel like you're just getting something slightly more in depth. And one of the tips that they mentioned that I wasn't aware of was that you should check out both periorbital muscle and thumb adductor recovery. Apparently the eye muscle recovery correlates to your diaphragmatic strength, but your thumb adductor recovery correlates with your upper airway recovery, and they actually don't really relate well to each other. So you should never just check one muscle recovery, you should check both. Then I looked in the C-Cup. The October edition of C-Cup has got a selection of good articles. The one I enjoyed most, probably an overview of non-opioid-based adjuvant analgesia and perioperative care. And really what it seems is that ketamine is continuing to enjoy its 15 minutes of fame. There seems to be good evidence to back its ability to reduce both acute perioperative pain and subsequent opioid consumption. And then, Frank, I thought you probably read there's a really good one on TOE for high-risk surgery, but it was it was beyond me with my interest in obstetric anaesthesia. Looking at the AAGBI website, they've got they do those tutorials of the week, and the most recent one was on fetal heart rate monitoring and CTG. So, as an anaesthetist, actually, that's probably worth reading. Otherwise, usually when I'm on labour ward and I have a look at a CTG, I feel a bit like an orthopod looking at an ECG. So I thought this might improve my abilities on labour ward. So yeah, there's a few good things out there to occupy ourselves with.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. We'll put links to those, particularly the Medscape videos, which sound great, onto the website. And finally, in our lightning news round, Frank, what was in the Anesthesia Press this month?
So a couple of journals which were, or publications which were pretty quiet. The AAGBI Anesthesia News didn't really have a lot in it, apart from Will Harrop Griffith's tongue-in-cheek take on the Francis Report, which makes for an entertaining introduction. He shares his frustration with our obsession with safety cannulas. But not much else in there. Oh, I did think I'd mention, because this slipped under the radar last month, but there's a review for an excellent physics book in last month's journals. Rick, I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, I didn't see that. Which was that in the AAGBI, in the Anesthesia News?
No, I think that was in Anesthesia last month.
Oh, was that the one where they were disappointed with the ventilator section?
No, I don't think so. No, oh, it was okay. A glowing review, and in fact, I think I may have told you already, but I found two copies of your physics book in the St. George's Library.
Oh, wow.
So, good to know. Congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Then, in the BJA, a couple of things. The ones I picked up on are, again, reasonably topical, but an article on antifibrinolytic agents in current anesthetic practice and a good review of the use of a proteinin in tranexamic acid and epsilon aminocaproic acid. So anyone interested in that, that's probably worth a read, and they look at sort of different applications for use of antifibrinolytics in various surgical specialties. Also, what caught my attention is there's an article on propofol for adult procedural sedation in UK emergency departments, and they look at the safety profile in 1,008 cases, and it looks like it was written by emergency physicians. And I'm sure we've all been called down to A&E, and I've certainly been a bit wary of or discovering what actually goes on when you're not around, and lots of propofol and midazolam is being bandied about. But I've got to say that they, and I didn't realize this, but following on from the article, there is really good guidance from the college, and it's a joint Royal College of Anaesthetists and College of Emergency Medicine publication on safe sedation of adults in the emergency department, and probably a good reference to share with your emergency department colleagues if you find that they're a bit heavy-handed on the sedation. In Anesthesia, mirroring our podcast interests, there's more on isolated forearm technique, and Dr. Russell's back now with isolated forearm and isoflurane anesthesia, not just propofol. And again, also things we've picked up before in the podcast, but nice guidance on BIS monitoring and depth of anesthesia monitoring. The other article I thought was interesting in Anesthesia was the use of magnesium sulfate infusions on the incidence and severity of emergence agitation in children. This was in kids undergoing adenotonsillectomies with sevoflurane anesthesia from a group in Egypt, and they were giving 30 milligrams per kilogram of magnesium sulfate and then a 10 milligram per kilogram per hour infusion, and seemed to have good effect. So if you're like me and have lots of crying kids at the end of your anaesthetic, it might be another thing to consider. What else? Actually, the other thing in anaesthesia is part of my discovery, so I might keep it for then. And then looking at across the pond, anaesthesia and analgesia, there was something that looked quite interesting. There's someone actually from the UK, but it's obviously been published in one of the American journals, but they've developed pulse oximetry technology. And they've got a way now of applying it directly to an organ, so you can put it onto or into the esophagus, onto liver, bowel, or stomach, or free flap, and it will give you the same information as a more traditionally placed pulse oximetry probe. And I just thought that technology is available, and obviously they're developing it, but it would be quite useful if you imagine you've got you can incorporate it with an esophageal temperature probe, for example, and we've all sometimes struggled with peripherally shut down patients or artifact from surgeons bumping into the finger with a probe on and so on. But I think in the future you might well have a single probe that might do an esophageal temperature as well as pulse oximetry from esophageal mucosa. And then the other application which they mentioned, obviously, is free flap surgery and just keeping an eye on perfusion and oxygenation of free flaps. And that is all I got from the anesthesia journals.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, everybody. I feel informed and up to date. So that takes us on to our discovery section, which I probably look forward to the most. Mark, why don't you kick us off?
I will do then. I have a non-work related gadget discovery this week. Seeing as it was my birthday, I got a new watch. And for all of you fellow nerds and geeks out there, you'd be pleased to know that my watch communicates with my mobile phone devices, so I not only can tell the time, but get my emails and text messages and
watch.
All of that directly to my watch. Also, yeah, I can use apps on my phone to change the watch face, and Rick, you'll be delighted to know that at the moment I have a binary time-telling watch face on.
Oh, so that is awesome.
It takes me about 3 minutes each time I want to know what the time is. But I can do it. It's called a Pebble watch and works with Android and iOS. So yeah, a bit of fun, and it looks quite nice.
What's the point?
Bex clearly wants one now.
I don't understand. You've got your phone in your pocket, and then you need.
It's in your pocket. That's the point. That is the point. Your phone is in your pocket.
But you can't wear it bare below the elbows anyway.
But the time taken to take your mobile phone out of your pocket to check the time is going to be shorter than working out your binary whatever on your watch. So actually, it's delaying.
He'll get used to telling time in binary.
All watches are pointless. I haven't worn a watch for 3 or 4 years, and it's essentially jewellery, isn't it?
Yeah. And you're far too manly for that.
It's nerd jewellery. I love it.
Yeah. Such a bunch of dorks.
What you should do is get it made into a great big medallion that you can wear on the wards.
God. Well, it gets worse. There is an API, so you can program your own watch faces. So watch this space, maybe. I'll take it to the next level.
Please, can you put a picture of that on the podcast? I need to see it.
Yes, we will. We'll get a picture of Mark trying to work the time out in binary. Excellent. Stick that on the notes. Great. Any anesthesia related ones for you this month, or are we just sticking to fashion?
I've had a month off. I barely remember what work is.
Brilliant. All right, I'll go next with, I've got one actually, they're both non-anesthesia, but never mind. So I was in Starbucks this morning, looking through the news, and I was really enjoying the CD that was playing in the background, and I asked them what it was, and it was a Starbucks specially created mix of music that the customers can't buy. But the barista did reveal that, in fact, a lot of people do ask for the CD and say this is a great mix of music. Having done a little bit of thinking about it and having a look online, I think what they've done is employed some people to look at the demographic of customers who typically go in, pick music from the not only the era that they're likely to be into, but also the sort of people, like me, who sit in Starbucks for hours and hours and spend a huge amount of money, and then used some service, I'm not sure what it is, to work out what their music tastes are. Because I've never sat there and listened to a collection of music that I've enjoyed so much.
Not since you had the greatest hits of the Backstreet Boys.
Precisely. But I thought that was an interesting piece of it's not social engineering, but social psychology that Starbucks has obviously paid someone to spend a lot of money doing that works. Do you think it's creepy, or do you think it's quite cool that they've spent the time working out who their customers are, what their customers are going to enjoy, to the extent that they're constantly getting people asking for the CD, which they then can't supply?
I don't know. I think it's an anomaly that you happen to have liked it, because by definition, if me and you were in there together, if you liked it, I would almost certainly dislike it.
Ah, but you see, this is what they've done, though. They've looked at, you don't spend close to £100 in Starbucks a month, whereas I do. So I'm the customer. I'm the person they're looking for.
Do you like about Starbucks is the Starbucks app. Have you got that? You don't even need to carry money. You just
That's why I never spend money, because Rick likes using his app so much that he always pays when we go to Starbucks.
And I was going
to
say, I think someone who spends £100 a month at Starbucks has almost definitely got the app.
Anyway, so that's number one. Number two, which is probably of more use to everyone else. So I'm working on an entirely electric ICU at the moment, where there are no paper notes. Everything is there's a computer by each individual patient, and we're using a system called ISIP, which I have mixed feelings about, but generally I think is a really, really good IT system. But we have those, you know, those blue keyboards and blue rubberized mouses that are clean, infection, right, you know them. And you know they always have, there's an amber light which flashes on them to tell you when it needs cleaning.
Yeah.
So lots of hospitals have them. I find that amber light really, really annoying because every single keyboard is flashing it. No one's cleaning them. And it's not so much the cleanliness. I find the amber light distracting because it's saying to me, do something. I don't know what to do.
Isn't that the whole purpose of the light?
Well, that is the whole purpose of the light. But you've got to go and find a cleaning wipe and clean it. And then it does actually go off, which a microbiologist showed me the other day. I thought there was some kind of... I didn't know how it worked. But that's what you do. You literally just wipe it and it goes off, which is great. However, you've got to go and find a wipe and wipe it. So the way this system works is it's got two electrical connections and a pressure detector. And they've got to be done within a certain amount of time from each other. So it knows that it's been essentially wiped clean and at a relevant pressure or whatever that the keyboard is now clean. Anyway, I've discovered the way to bypass it without cleaning if that amber light is annoying you. I'm not saying this is in any way...
That's the spirit.
Not saying this is any way a substitute for cleaning it, but if you put your fingers on the metal studs, which make an electrical connection at the two tops of the keyboard, press on both of those, and then wipe your thumb sort of relatively hard along the little block of six buttons with the page down, page up, home end. If you wipe it along the bottom of them, that's where the pressure sensor is, and the amber light will stop flashing.
There's an infection control nurse out there somewhere going nuts right now.
They're all nuts, all nuts. Don't worry about it.
So that's the way that works. And those are my terribly useful discoveries. Frank.
What have I got? I think I've taken over from Bex's position as app promoter of the month. So unfortunately, I have got two more apps to tell you about. So one app is from the International Anesthesia Research Society, which is an American organization, and they run the Open Anesthesia website, and they've launched a self-study app for anesthetic, not just trainees, but primarily aimed at people studying for the exams. And although it is aimed at American trainees, I looked through some of the questions and they're all actually really good and obviously just as relevant to people preparing for exams here. And the great benefit of it is that they give you 200 questions for free. As I said, relevant to our sort of syllabus as well. And you can go through them, you can do a whole test or just a couple of questions at a time. And not only do they obviously tell you when you've got correct or wrong answers, but they do have a little blurb with some explanation and some links to follow as well. So if you're trapped on a long plastics list and the FRCA is looming, I'd suggest you download this, and it's an easy way of just doing some quick revision. The other app I was going to mention was something called iLarynx, and if you've looked through this one's anesthesia, you'll see that it's actually in there from a small study that the developers of the app put together. The study itself isn't all that impressive in the sense that it's a small study, and it basically just shows that people who use iLarynx did slightly better than those who didn't in terms of intubation. But as you can imagine from the name, all it is a iOS app that basically allows you to virtually intubate or gives you the fiber optic view for virtual intubation of a patient. I think the most useful thing about it is that it's a nice, easy, and accessible way of explaining the anatomy to trainees or people you might be working with and whom you want to describe the process of fiber optic intubation. And using the app, it's got sort of similar controls to a fiber optic scope. And you can just slowly go through the mouth, behind the tongue, see the epiglottis, go down into the trachea, and I think it's just a safe way of describing the anatomy if, for example, you're going to then go on to supervise someone doing it. It's obviously free, so that's always good. And it's got reasonable graphics and it's all animated, and you can choose between a sort of a awake breathing patient, if you like, which obviously means that the cords are moving and the epiglottis is moving, or a paralyzed patient. And I think there's one other option for someone with an airway tumor, which doesn't really add very much to it. Just as a useful teaching tool, go check that out.
Oh, cool.
Great. Thank you very much. And Bex, what are you going to do now that Frank's stolen the apps?
And it's to do with the airway.
I know.
I'm quite gutted. Well, I'm afraid my discovery is not very relevant to most people, but does anyone remember that group called Amateur Transplants? They did the song The Anaesthetist Hymn.
Yes.
Oh, they're the guys that stole Mark's material.
They
You can't say that, but it's absolutely true.
So my discovery is that they are still going, actually. Well, part of the group is still going. So it's a guy called Adam Kay, and he was an anaesthetist. I think he was on the Imperial rotation, and then possibly, from what I could gather, didn't spend quite enough time studying and spent more time making up songs about surgeons.
Libelous.
And had to give up his anaesthetic career. But he now does comedy full-time, and he has a monthly slot at the Pleasance Theatre in Islington, and it is really, really worth going to. It was he does sort of stand-up comedy, and he does a lot of singing to songs where he's changed the words, but it was incredibly politically incorrect, but it's absolutely hysterical. So for anyone who has a free Friday night and £12.50 for the ticket, I really, really recommend that you go and take a look. It's absolutely brilliant.
Mark and I know Adam quite well, actually. He's a nice guy with some quite extraordinary hobbies, including one of which at some time was collecting taxidermied animals, if I remember correctly. I think he was at med school when he had this hobby as well, which is an odd one. But yeah, he's a nice guy. Definitely go and see his shows. Great. So, progressing forward onto our article. Mark, it's an ambitious one you've picked this month, but why don't you take us through what a lot of very clever people have to say about the incredibly important topic of perioperative fluids?
Yeah, well, as you've said, this is quite a big paper, hence why I chose it. It's a subject that we've talked about several times on the podcast. Fluids or cardiac output monitoring or goal-directed therapy, these things come up a lot. As you said, very clever people. There's a list of authors that is world-renowned and distinguished and looks like it's been taken straight off of your Christmas card list, Rick. some of which are quite local to us. So the full title of this article in this month's, that's October's British Journal of Anesthesia, is Perioperative Increase in Global Blood Flow to Explicit Defined Goals and Outcomes After Surgery, a Cochrane Systematic Review. I always am interested in Cochrane reviews. I think they've had a good history of some sound science there, so that caught my eye. So what's this paper all about? So this is a systematic review and meta-analysis which is going to summarise the clinical effects of increasing perioperative blood flow using fluids with or without inotropes or vasoactive drugs to explicit defined goals in adults. So what we already know, patients undergoing surgery are more likely to die or have complications if they have a limited physiological reserve. We also know that traditionally monitored vital signs, that's our heart rate and blood pressure and all that, are poor predictors of mortality when compared to flow-based variables such as cardiac output or oxygen delivery. We've known these things for a good 30 years now, and over that time there have become more and more ways of monitoring and manipulating the cardiovascular system, usually on the hypothesis that targeting goals for cardiac output or oxygen delivery would improve outcomes by improving tissue perfusion and hence oxygenation. So as we know only too well, there have been numerous trials looking at these issues, but unfortunately they differ quite widely in terms of the case mix that's been looked at, types of operation, severity, comorbidities. They differ in what techniques for monitoring flow are used, what goals are targeted, what techniques are used to achieve these goals, and what happens to the control group. So that's why we've ended up with a lot of studies that don't always agree with each other. Also studies that are not blinded or have small numbers, or reviews that are not systematic, leaving this whole subject to be slightly confusing for people like me. So what's different about this one? What have they done? These guys have got together with the Cochrane database people and have done a massive data search using the Cochrane Central Register of Controlled Trials and Medline and Embase and proceedings of all relevant conferences. So they've come up with a massive number of papers initially. They included all RCTs in any language with patients over the age of 16, anyone who's had fluids between 24 hours before surgery and 6 hours after surgery, whether or not inotropes were used. And they looked for papers in which people were looking at explicitly measured goals for cardiac output or oxygen delivery or cardiac index or stroke volume index or all of those type of things. The authors looked through all of the titles and abstracts, and I found it quite amusing. Their little quote was that we resolved any disagreements by discussion. So some long nights, I would imagine.
Over a beer in the pub.
Having collected all these papers and weeded out the ones they wanted, which I'll come back to, they did some extremely hardcore stats. I've titled this section of my notes Stats Nightmare because I don't really, as usual, fully get it. But the things that they've discussed in their methods is that they looked for inconsistencies and variability. They assessed evidence of reporting bias using contour-enhanced funnel plots with a subsequent Harbord or Eggers test, which is exactly what I would do in that situation. They used intention-to-treat method for all analyses. And then another bit that we'll come back to that confuses me is that they say they used both fixed effect and random effect models for primary outcome analysis. I'm going to expect Rick to explain that to us all shortly. So, what did they find? Well, amazingly, they turned up 18,000 or nearly 19,000 publications on their first search. When they weeded out duplicates, that dropped to about 10,000. But actually, only 66 of those were initially assessed as eligible. And after excluding a few more for being trauma-related or sepsis-related, they ended up with only 31 studies. Now, most of these studies were relatively small, with patient numbers of between 50 and 200. There was a couple with the numbers in the 300s and one with nearly 2,000, which left the total number of patients in the review as just over 5,000. The authors discuss quite a lot on the methods of randomization and blinding and bias in these studies, but I'm not going to go into all of that. The primary outcome that they wanted to look at for all of these papers was mortality, and their results showed a mortality of overall 8.9% in the intervention group versus 10.8% in the control group, which gives a risk ratio of 0.89 in favour of the intervention. However, p-value of nearly 2 there, which is not very statistically significant. This is where the paper loses me a little bit, because the authors then say that the results did gain significance when using the random effects model. And they have a table that seems to show to me they've processed the same numbers with several different models and come out with completely different risk ratios and p-values depending on the model, which is, for a layperson like me, a little bit like when people say that you can prove anything with statistics if you do the right test. So again, I'm going to ask Rick to explain that to us in a moment. Because of the heterogeneity of all of the papers included, they did a lot of subgroup analysis, seeing if they could find if there was a difference with things like timing of interventions, type of interventions, the goals, the type of surgery, mode of surgery, and all of those kind of things. And the only subgroup that achieved any statistical significance was when all of the studies, including emergency cases, were removed, just leaving behind elective cases. So, looking at some secondary endpoints, they looked at morbidity. Now, this I would imagine was really difficult because the studies included all defined, investigated, and reported morbidity in several different ways. And in fact, the authors say, and I quote, "No two studies used the same list of morbidities after surgery. In most cases, no specific criteria were listed for morbidities. No two studies used the same criteria." So, in other words, they had to do quite a lot of this manually and trying to group together studies which were similar. And they looked at a whole list of specific morbidities. To save you some time, there are three that came up with a significant improvement following these flow-related interventions. That is, the risk of renal impairment, you have a relative risk of 0.71. Respiratory failure or ARDS with a relative risk of 0.51. And the risk of wound infection with a relative risk of 0.65, all in favour of intervention. But in other morbidities, they found no differences in rates of arrhythmia, infections, myocardial infarction, heart failure, or thromboembolism. So, despite all of that, they then looked at a different way, which is the number of patients with complications. And that did show a significant difference. So again, it seems a little bit like you can find what you want depending on how you phrase the question to me. But there was an improvement in the number of patients with complications and an average improvement in hospital stay of around about a day. So, having waded through a lot of confusing stats, in the discussion the authors say that the key finding of this review is that the perioperative administration of fluids with or without vasoactive drugs targeted to increase global blood flow defined by explicit measured goals reduced postoperative complications and length of stay but did not reduce mortality. That's quite a mouthful of a sentence, so one bit I found more useful to understand these results is that they say for every 100 patients exposed to this type of treatment, one can expect 13 in 100 to avoid a complication, 2 to avoid renal impairment, 5 to avoid respiratory failure, and 4 to avoid postoperative wound infection, with no effects on other types of morbidity. So, limitations. I've mentioned a few of my perceived limitations as we've gone along. The authors identify quite a few more of their own, particularly the heterogeneity and data quality variability in the existing trials. The fact that a good number of the included studies were small with fewer than 100 patients. The fact that they can't formally exclude publication bias or language bias given the databases they used to search. They mention flaws in the original study designs and the fact that this FORUS systematic review has a relatively small number of papers included. My biggest concern is like I say, if I don't understand all of the models and tests used in statistics and they appear to have done lots of different ones, how do I know which one I should pay attention to? Rick.
Okay. So start off by saying I've not had as much time to spend on this as I would have liked, but also I think to go through this in detail would be a whole podcast in itself. And what I would recommend to anyone who's really, I mean, meta-analysis and guidelines are two very important things and something, a huge part of what they do, of what we do in anesthesia, where we're a specialty where we're treating a large number of people in quite a similar way. Critical care as well, much the same thing. And we've got such a massive scope of practice that we do use a lot of guidelines, and these are also dependent on meta-analyses. What I can recommend to anybody is I did a podcast for the BJA with Georgie Imberger, who's a clinician scientist completing a PhD in meta-analysis and uncertainty. And she's given a really nice talk, it's about 20 minutes, from the point of view of someone who conducts these type of meta-analyses and generates these guidelines. And goes through some of the things you might not realise about it, and in fact how, when you get something from a big question like this through to a meta-analysis down to a guideline and recommendation, how the process works, and in fact how much subjectivity there is in it, although in this paper they've shown they've done the meta-analysis stage, which is only one stage with a great deal of objectivity. But I can recommend downloading the podcast and listening to what she has to say about it, because she's very eloquent, really knows what she's talking about, and I think it really gives you a good insight to anybody, well, most people won't have ever gone through this exercise, to how it's done. The second thing I would say is there's lots of really good resources out there on the Cochrane website to help explain some of these really complex statistical methods, which is what I use because I'm not in any way, shape or form any sort of expert in them. So just drilling down a bit onto this paper, what I took from it was, I think that a couple of things they say in the first, I think it's a really nicely done paper and I think they've had a really fair look at this topic. And as we said before, some very clever people coming to some quite nebulous conclusions, and I'm not quite sure what their end game here is, but I think reading between the lines, what they're trying to say is that we need to really think about how we look at this topic and how we design our clinical trials in order to get some interpretable results. One of the first sentences they start off with is that it's been 30 years since optimization of oxygen delivery has been shown to make a difference in some degree, and yet in their meta-analysis they've only managed to find 5,292 participants to include in well-conducted trials, which is not a big number considering in theatre, one of the main thing, well, the two main things we do is put people to sleep and then we give them fluids. And there's so much debated and discussion about what fluid and how much, but yet this meta-analysis has revealed a relative paucity of useful studies for us to actually analyse. They've found, through their clever statistical methods, that the results of the meta-analysis are very sensitive to the methods used, which I'll talk about in just a second. But that in itself is quite indicative of the fact that, you know, these probably aren't so robust. Lots of the trials were underpowered, single centres, and with very small numbers, which again is reflected by the fact that our meta-analysis only includes very small numbers. When I was talking earlier about, in the news, about the article which was a meta-analysis of social networking and survivability, we were looking at nearly a million participants, I think, or at least in the 100,000s. This is only 5,292 people. And think how many people undergo surgery per year. That's a very, very, very small percentage. They talk about funnel plots and small study effects, which I'll briefly talk about. A funnel plot, there's a really good, again, looking at the Cochrane website, Noddy's Guide to How Funnel Plots Work. And the small study effect is having a look at a funnel plot and showing that the smaller the study, in other words, probably the less scientific, what's the word I'm looking for? Reduced quality of the study, probably because of the small number of participants, the greater the effects they found. And that sort of skews your funnel plot a little bit, which again shows that the evidence base you're looking at is probably not very, very robust. And they had one study which accounted for 67% of the data they actually included, which again will definitely skew your data. Now, attempts to not skew your data are these random and fixed effects models. And again, I don't understand them sufficiently to be able to give you a good explanation of how you break these down. But I have found a paper which I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs from to see if this helps tie it all up for you guys, and you can let me know if it does. So obviously, the point of meta-analysis is to estimate an overall or combined effect for what we're trying to look for in the papers we're analysing. So this is me quoting from this paper, which is a 162-page document, which I will only do a couple of paragraphs from. If all studies in the analysis were equally precise, we could simply compute the mean of the effect sizes. However, if some studies were more precise than others, we would want to assign more weight to the studies that carried more information. And this is what we do in meta-analysis. Rather than compute a simple mean of the effect sizes, we compute a weighted mean with more weight given to some studies and less weight given to others. The question that we need to address then is how the weights are assigned. It turns out that this depends on what we mean by a combined effect. There are two models used in meta-analysis, the fixed effect model and the random effects model. The two make different assumptions about the nature of the studies, and these assumptions lean to different definitions for the combined effect and different mechanisms for assigning weights. And this is partly all enrolled in the heterogeneity of the meta-analyses you're looking at. And again, they go to great pains in the article to point out that these meta-analyses are measuring different interventions for different populations with different outcome variables, and they're trying to tie all of this together to give us some useful advice on how we should manage our fluids, which is a very difficult thing. So, computing a combined effect. Under the fixed effect model, all studies are estimating the same effect size, and so we can assign weights to all studies based entirely on the amount of information captured by that study. A large study would be given the lion's share of the weight, and a small study would be largely ignored, which is what we were just talking about with study effects, funnel plots, and the fact that 67% came from one particular study. By contrast, under the random effects model, we're trying to estimate the mean of a distribution of true effects. Large studies may yield more precise estimates than small studies, but each study is estimating a different effect size, and each of these effect sizes serves as a sample from the population whose mean we want to estimate. Therefore, as compared with a fixed effect model, the weights under random effects are more balanced. Large studies are less likely to dominate the analysis, and small studies are less likely to be trivialized. So it's two different ways of looking at your data based partially on the heterogeneity of what you're looking at. However, I think the real take-home message from this paper is that The data set's too heterogeneous. It's way too small. Lots of the studies haven't been conducted in a robust way, so it's probably impossible to take this meta-analysis forward to actually publish a guideline. And I think their discussion goes through all of these points in I think it's really, really well discussed, and they break it down in quite an interpretable way. And they say in their final paragraph of the discussion is that research should focus on answering these questions using large multi-centered studies, which again is always the thing for... No, do they say that? Yeah. So they say future research will hopefully disentangle a complex package of care that forms the intervention and thereby identify which components are effective in the different clinical context. I think this is too large a question that's being... People are attempting to find the answer in too much of a large kind of sporadic way, and we need more focused, better designed trials.
Thanks. Well, that did help. If you could put links to some of those sources you mentioned explaining those things on our site, I will try and read them.
Brilliant. Anybody else?
Complicated.
nothing to add, really. I mean, I think this is probably the best sort of look at all the trials we have got. But I mean, as you're saying, that's as good information as we have. I mean, they do mention there's a reasonably big trial ongoing now with recruiting about 700, I think. And I think as these sort of techniques are becoming more and more common, and we've recently had an email about how obviously NHS patients you can now charge if you use intraoperative cardiac output or monitoring or goal-directed therapy. So most of our patients are going to get this. And I think people are trying to look at a firmer evidence base to be able to justify it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the studies they've included as well, or some of the studies are a little bit on the old side when cardiac output monitoring was not probably as good as it is now. Although I think there's still a lot of people I'm working with at the moment who are not that impressed by some of the cardiac monitors out there. I actually put a PA catheter down someone for some cardiac output monitoring for... virtually an annual event for me at the moment, but it's interesting. This patient had a PA catheter on and a Lidco, and they're giving completely different figures. Trends were, to be fair, were the same, but the figures were miles off from each other in that N equals one observational piece of rubbish I've just said.
It's still a worry, though.
It is a worry. It is a worry. And this was with the rep from one of the... PA catheters from rep from Edwards there as well, of course insisting that hers was the more accurate, which to be fair I think in terms of, again I think we've talked about this before, in terms of how the PA catheter was doing its cardiac output, was deriving its cardiac output, it's far more understandable to me because we actually learn about dilutional methods and how that derives cardiac output, as opposed to pulse contour analysis, which is still a very much a black box technology.
It's a secret algorithm,
right,
which makes it hard to understand.
Yeah.
Precisely. You know, the FIC method is not secret. It's been written about by loads of people, and you can understand it. Pulse contour analysis, secret. So I'm more inclined to go with the PA catheter, but of course there's all the problems with using them, or at least perceived problems. Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mark. I think that's an interesting article, and with some complex stats. And I do think for anyone reading it, we'll put the article up. We'll put lots of links to things which you'd have to sort of sit down. I think it's a 45-minute read, isn't it? Sort of sit down, read it, and try and have a look, and try and get the most out of it by trying to understand some of the stats. But I've got to say, with these articles, I always feel terrified when I read them, because that you walk away from them thinking, I must be some kind of idiot because I only understood 20% of that. But my feeling is probably the majority of people will only understand a small portion of what's going on in there, hence the need for a sort of well-written discussion and conclusion.
And they did that in this paper. That's, even for me, they did a great job of making it understandable where possible.
I think that's true. Even I got a small percent. I wouldn't say 20%, but maybe slightly less.
Great. So from a challenging read onto a practical challenge, Frank, I think it's your turn to be in the hot seat and present Biology or Bunkum.
Are we doing the rant first?
Oh, God, I nearly forgot. Sorry, of course. Rebecca, your moment of glory.
I dodged a bullet.
No. I remember you asked specifically at the end of last podcast, could you do the rant? Because obviously something has really been irritating you. So we are going to need some more jingles for this, aren't we, with the new format. But Bex, let us have it.
Well, I do want to disappoint, but I didn't do a rant. I didn't feel that I would be able to achieve Mark's greatness on the rant. So instead, I've come up with my own version, and it's called Rebecca's Rhyme. And I've written a poem for you guys. try not to take the piss too much. It's a long time since I did anything vaguely like this. Okay, you ready?
On tenterhooks.
Okay. I work at a centre of excellence, and what an excellent centre it is, where every anaesthetic given involves the use of Teva and the Bis. I'm at a loss for things to complain about. The cupboards are stocked, not bare. Come check out our storeroom. 4 Bronx, 2 sonocytes, and an echo machine in there. We've got red brick walls and sash windows. Makes our building look so posh. The carpet in the entrance hall is knee-deep. It must have cost a lot of dosh. There's a receptionist that greets you every morning with a smile. And elevators that actually work, although admittedly they take a while. The intensive care unit is brand spanking new, thanks to that fire in 2008. With a sunny balcony for patients to sit on if the propofol's not made them too sedate. The nurses are proactive, competent and calm. There's never a midwife in sight. The surgeons are slick and quick, that rare combination of competent and polite. I couldn't believe it in January when I was given my very own locker. A place to put my purse and shoes. Such high-flying living is a shocker. There's 4 computers in the office for just the 8 of us to share, and a designated doctor's fridge to leave your lunch in, if you so care. Peter Andre, Prince Harry and Andy Murray have all come for a visit. So you see, there's more than just a nice building that makes this place so exquisite. And so now, entering winter, with the end of my fellowship drawing near, the fact that I'm going to have to leave soon makes me want to shed a tear. I'll be heading back to a DGH. It's like staring into the abyss. I'll be at another dodgy hospital that aims for mediocrity, but still manages to miss.
Oh, that's very, very good. Well done. That's incredibly good.
Finishing school paid off. Thanks.
Nice work.
How exciting.
That was brilliant. That was really, really good. You're going to, you should type that out and give that to the Marsden. They could probably have it up on their walls and frame, or certainly in their doctor's mess.
Yeah, I've entitled it The Ode to the Marsden.
That was excellent. Thank you very much, Rebecca. I really, really enjoyed that.
Pleasure.
Excited to see who it's going to be next month on the random spreadsheet generator. Right, so finally, just to finish up, Frank, you're in the presenting hot seat this month for Biology or Bunkum. So why don't you take it away to finish us off?
Okay, guys, so for Biology or Bunkum this month, and it's my first time hosting, but I thought I'd give you a couple of stories about novel ways of delivering oxygen. So 2 of these are true, 1 of them isn't, and you know the deal. So the first one is a team from the Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, has developed an injectable foam suspension containing self-assembling lipid-based microparticles which encapsulate a core of pure oxygen gas and can be injected intravenously. Prototype suspensions were manufactured to contain between 50 and 90 mils of oxygen gas per deciliter. And when the microparticles were infused by intravenous injection into hypoxemic rabbits, arterial saturations increased within seconds to near normal levels, and this was followed by a decrease in oxygen tensions after stopping the infusions. The second one is Hemospan, also known as MP40X, is a polyethylene glycol conjugated human hemoglobin currently undergoing clinical trials. To produce in a powder form, the powder can be mixed into liquid and transfused immediately, regardless of a patient's blood type. And the technology relies on coupling with polyethylene glycol to eliminate the toxicity associated with free hemoglobin. The manufacturers believe that the product can be stored for years and that they've optimized certain factors involved in oxygen delivery. in the production of hemospan so that the product ultimately presents the right amount of oxygen to the blood vessel wall. And in animal models, MP40X has been shown to be effective in cases of hemorrhagic shock. And then lastly, researchers in Japan under Tsuyoshi Suzuki are developing octoglobin, a new type of oxygen-carrying protein based on hyperbranched polymer-protected porphyrins derived from plastic compounds. The iron-containing porphyrin is able to bind oxygen reversibly and is protected by a polymer or dendrimer shell. This new molecule will be able to carry 8 rather than 4 oxygen molecules and has similar dissociative properties to hemoglobin, allowing release of oxygen in peripheral tissues. It can be stored for years in a powdered form and is made up in a balanced salt solution prior to use. So, we've got basically injectable oxygen, something called hemospan, which is a sort of powdered hemoglobin, and a porphyrin, oxygen-carrying porphyrin, also powdered form, which you can mix up and inject as a solution.
And did you say that the last one came from that Suzuki bloke?
Yeah, it's Japanese researchers. Something called octoglobin is actually based on some research in Sheffield that they did on getting these compounds from sort of plastic derivatives, the hyperbranched polymer protected bit.
Okay, so I'll start. I think we're going with a little bit of deception in some truth. The standout one for me is the injectable foam, because that sounds like a horrible idea, but it's the only one that is actually going to increase your oxygen, increase your PaO2 by injection of the actual substance. The other two were just oxygen carrying devices. I wonder if you're trying to sell me a dummy. I feel like that. I want that to be true. So I'm going to say that is true, and the falsehood lies somewhere in the octoglobin story. So I'm going to say that is the bunkum.
Okay. Bex, do you want to go next?
I'm going with the last one being the bunkum, mainly because I'm suspicious of any Japanese research these days. And I don't think of Sheffield as a place that churns out a lot of research either. So I don't trust your story on that.
Sheffield's got quite an active anaesthetic research department.
Oh, all right. I'm still going with it. So I'm going to go with anyway, the dodgy Japanese.
Okay, so two of you so far with the Japanese, is that right? Yeah.
So my turn. So, well presented, Frank. You've got a knack for this. I think that just to be different from those two, I'm going to say the middle one is bunkum, because I think you've slightly tweaked it from something else that I have heard of.
Okay, so that means that Rick and Bex are tied on this occasion. Because, in fact, Tsuyoshi Suzuki is a music DJ. There is no such product as octoglobin. The rest of it is actually true, though. So, hyperbranched polymer-protected porphyrins were developed from plastic compounds in Sheffield. So you're quite right, Tsuyoshi Suzuki hasn't developed octoglobin, and that is something that probably isn't going to happen. Mark chose the hemospan or MP40X. That actually does exist. It's developed by a company called Sangart in California. And in fact, that's been trialed in patients, a Swedish trial which gave 90 patients undergoing hip arthroplasty hemospan and ringers as a control. I don't really understand the trial, not having looked into it, but they weren't really looking at oxygen carrying capacity. They just noticed that the people receiving hemospan didn't drop the pressures as much as the controls. So I'm not too sure how that vindicates the use of it. And the one I thought was most interesting was John Keir's development of these particle oxygen-carrying particles. So that is true. It's a polydispersed particle size. The mean particle diameters are between 2 and 4 micrometers, and they are very sort of cheap to make. They're just made from lipids, They're mixed with human blood outside of the body, and oxygen transfer occurs within 4 seconds, and then they can be infused. Obviously, I mean, the experience has been in rabbits, but they've done both infused into rabbits with 15 minutes of complete tracheal occlusion. And in those rabbits, the degree of hypoxemia was significantly decreased. Incidence of cardiac arrest and organ injury was reduced compared to controls. And then, as I said in the initial blurb, obviously they have been able to infuse and increase saturations whilst the infusion was being maintained. So it's something to watch. That's if
sounds
anyone's
kind of cool.
interested
yeah.
or knows about TED Talks, this guy John Keir gave a TED Talk on it, and there's an article in Nature about it that our very own Mervyn Singer has got something to say about as well. So we'll post links to that in the
Oh, fantastic. Website. We will definitely post links to both of those. Thank you very much, Frank. Mark, you seem to be suffering from me not presenting. Maybe it turns out your superiority at biology or bunkum was in fact getting inside my mind.
Yeah. Consider this the end of the
winning
streak.
unfair
so that's why this new format was suggested, I think, to cancel out the fact that I can read you like a cheap book.
Well, good. It's certainly making more exciting. I'm enjoying the new format for Biology or Bunkum. Well, thank you very much, everybody. That brings us to the end of this month's Gascast. We'll be back with the same next month. So thank you very much for listening.